We are back to discuss the Hork-Bajir Chronicles after a really long hiatus that we always accidentally take. So we're really glad that you're sticking with us and going to go with us on this journey into sadness as we discuss the Hork-Bajir Chronicles. I actually had never read them before. If you recall, when we did the Andalite Chronicles, I had also never read them before. And the reason why, Diana's shaking her
head. I'm still really confused by this. Like, because I owned both of them when we were children.
So I owned both of them, too. I still own them. That doesn't mean I read them. That's the summary of my entire library right there. I own it does not mean I read it. So, no, the reason why I didn't read them was because they didn't have our main characters in them. And so I was always a little bit less interested in reading something that didn't have, you know, direct pertinence to our core group, which is really silly because once I sat down and read this, I like devoured it and really loved it and think that it's like a really valuable exercise. And the same with Andalite Chronicles. And they both are very tragic because they both tell stories that we know happened, but they tell exactly how they happened and the complications of how they happened and how everything is sad. That's the basic outline there. There's an About the Author thing in the back. And after K.A. Applegate's biography, it gives a little blurb about the Hork-Bajir Chronicles. And it says, according to Ms. Applegate, quote, "The Hork-Bajir Chronicles is a book I've wanted to write for a long time. I wanted to show that most stories of conflict are more complicated than any one side would have you believe. Not that good and evil are impossible to find or define, just that reality is usually a little grayer around the edges." And I think that's, like, she definitely achieved that.
Yes, she did. Scarring tons of tweens along the way. Thank you, Kay.
I don't know, dude. I don't know if two tweens would be scarred, though. I feel like it's much more scarring as an adult, which is kind of what we've talked about in a recurring theme in this reread, is that, like, there are some super heavy, semi-traumatizing themes and conflicts that K.A. Applegate presents, and it's just like, wait a minute, this is for teenagers? And then we thought back, like, did we get this at the time? And, I don't know, sometimes the answer is yes, sometimes no.
It's always funny to me when, like, you know, there's these discussions in the media every now and then about how violent The Hunger Games is, or how violent Harry Potter is, and I just want to be like, how did K.A. skate under the radar? Like,
I don't know.
You know, I don't recall, my mom never, like, looked at my books and was like, you can't read that. No librarians ever stopped me from getting these out of the library, like, they would. But, you know, so it's like, this is not a new phenomenon. If for whatever reason, like, people just did, maybe because they had wacky covers.
That's exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking. I think that how they slipped by was that the cover art was, like, kind of borderline ridiculous. That, like, it was allowed people to not take them seriously and then just, like, sneak up on them when you open the book and actually read the content. It just punches you in the face with, like, really gray conflicts and, like, kind of horrific themes. So that was the point of Hork-Bajir Chronicles. The story that Hork-Bajir Chronicles tells is of the enslavement of the entire species of the Hork-Bajir, which is just, there's no way that, I mean, that's just, that's a horrible story, no matter where you, like, what way you shake it, is the story of an entire enslavement, like, ugh. Of course, by the Yerks, and the Animorphs, it's framed with Tobias, who played a big part in, you know, starting the Hork-Bajir colony, if you remember. I don't remember what book it is, so if you remember, tell me, please.
No, it's 12, I think.
Is it 12? All right. In 12, they're able to free two Hork-Bajir controllers from the Yerks, and they start, like, a little Hork-Bajir colony in a valley nearby. And the Elemist kind of does them a solid by making it, like, basically hard to find. And so Tobias is sort of close to them, and being that he's a bird, he can get there easily. And so he goes to hang out with the Hork-Bajir, and Jara Hami. We don't know how to say anything. So you're probably undergoing that ridiculous, like, reader thing where when you read it a certain way and then other people say it, and you're like, I don't say it like that in my head, but who's to say that's right? We don't know. This is all up in the air. So Jara, Hami, he tells Tobias the story of the enslavement of the Hork-Bajir, but really, the story came to him through his grandfather? Grandfather or great-grandfather? Grandfather?
It's an oral tale.
Yeah.
Passed down.
Yeah.
Through the main family.
Yeah, through the family by Dak Hami, who is not really the main character in the Hork-Badur Chronicles, but kind of.
He's one of two.
I think he's like, I really love him and think he's super compelling, and I also don't quite understand how K.A. Applegate wrote a Hork-Badur to be so, like, studly. I don't understand it.
Seriously, I would hit that.
I know, exactly. I agree. Do you agree with us? Because please let us know please let us know we're not alone in reading the Hork-Badur Chronicles and thinking that Dak Hami was like, you know, ugh, so handsome. Yeah, the babe. He's such a babe. So the story is of Dak Hami, who lives in the Hork-Badur world, who has been told by his Hork-Badur compatriots that he is special. He is different. He is a seer. And that he's sort of destined for something beyond what most Hork-Badur are destined for. And this is sort of sparked when the other main character, Aldrea, comes to live on the Hork-Badur world as well. She's an Andalite, and she's not just any old Andalite. She is the daughter of Prince Ciro, who, if you recall, is a disgrace to the entire Andalite people. That's horrible. That's a horrible way to put it.
Hard.
The deal with Prince Ciro is that he loved peace and humanity and was sort of fascinated by different alien species and stuff like that. And he felt super bad that the Yurks are, you know, kind of helpless. They can't do anything without a host. And so they just live really sad, mundane lives with their blind slugs in, like, murky pools on their crappy homeworld. And he was like, well, that sucks. Like, I wonder if, like, we can do something about that. And so he basically, I guess he gave, did he just help them enslave the Geds? Or did he, like, give them technology? I can't even remember now.
It was more like he was, like, the ambassador, and they, at his urging, you know, they swapped technology with them, and they set up, like, you know, an Andalite Yurk peace thing. And so then, you know, after this, the Yurks had ships, and they had treaders, and they had, you know, computers or whatever the Andalites have is way advanced for computers. So they had stuff. And
yeah,
then they used that stuff.
Well, not only that, but they super betrayed, like, Ciro really badly. Like, they just took advantage of him and didn't, they saw him as, like, a fool as well, kind of, for giving up all of that information and that sort of, like, access to power that the Andalites had, when in fact, like, it was a really nice thing for him to do. And that's why, I mean, the law is called the Law of Ciro's Kindness, but what's ironic is that everybody, like, sort of spits the name of that law, and Aldrea, as his daughter, experiences a lot of shame for that, because if there's one thing that the Andalites sort of operate on, it's, like, arrogance, pride, and shame. And so what happens is, because Prince Ciro has shamed the family, they send the whole family, Aldrea, her mom, her dad, and her brother, to an outpost on the Hork-Badur world, basically to just sort of, like, babysit the Hork-Badur and, like, keep an eye on them, like, study them, because they didn't think that anybody was going to bother the Hork-Badur. Because the Hork-Badur are a very peaceful species. They're kind of low intelligence compared to Andalites. And it was sort of like a, like, busy work for Ciro to do, to get him away from all of the other Andalites. And Aldrea comes to the Hork-Badur world and is the only one that kind of, like, steps outside of her family, and she meets Dak Hami and they become friends. And she learns about the Hork-Badur culture, and she teaches him, like, everything, basically. Yeah, like, math, like, understanding, like, complex, like, emotional concepts, like, abstract thinking, like, vocabulary. She basically teaches him everything, and within, you know, a small amount of time, he's functioning at the same level as she is, pretty much, which is extraordinarily, like, rare for Hork-Badur, and that's part of, like, what Dak Hami is, as, like, a seer. Ugh, I need help now. What's going on?
Well, what's going on is that someone woke up and realized that the Hork-Badur are walking weapons.
Yeah.
They
oh.
Weaponized them.
I forgot. Yay. We have to mention.
Honestly, what?
I was gonna say we have to mention our third player.
In
our third. We would love to not mention this douche. But unfortunately,
well, he's kind of interesting.
He is interesting. Well, he's a necessary component to what K.A. Applegate is putting forth as, like, the, like, credo of this book. Because the third component, the point of view, it switches between Eldrea and Dak, and then the third is Esplin 9466. So Esplin 9466 is a Yeerk who has big dreams of the big city, and by big city, I really just mean, like, domination and, you know, but living, really. That's the point of including Esplin, is that it's a point of view for us to understand how miserable it is to be in a Yeerk pool, and not have any access to, you know, visual sensation or anything. It's a horrible existence, and that's, like, the curse of the Yeerks, is that they require another species, you know, by which to sort of, like, do anything. But they're,
they have brains.
Yeah, they have brains, and they can learn, because, I don't know, Esplin talks about going to a Yeerk, like, library, basically, and learning all about the Andalites. Because that's his, like, his approach, is that in order to, he thinks that in order to gain power, he needs to make himself valuable to the Yeerks, and so he decides to learn everything he can about the Andalites, because he recognizes that eventually the Yeerks are going, their MO is to keep finding more and more powerful bodies to inhabit, because the Geds, let's face it, Aldrea describes the Geds at one point as having one leg longer than the other, and then she literally is like, I never understood, like, why they evolved that way. And that, for some reason, is really funny to me.
It's a valid question.
Like, why did the Geds, why? And, oh, poor Geds. Anyways, again, the Geds are not great hosts, so they want to, you know, move up in the world, which is how they get to the Hork-Bajir, which is how they get to the humans, in that the Yeerks are going to try and move up the ranks of species to infest, basically. Esplin realizes that Andalites are basically, like, the best that you can get. And so he immerses himself in Andalite culture and learns everything about them so that he has an opportunity to, like, be useful with that knowledge one day and hopefully eventually infest an Andalite, which we all know eventually happens. Wink. Well, that's the thing. That's the thing with the Andalite Chronicles and the Hork-Bajir Chronicles, is that the use of dramatic irony is just, like, all over the pages, because you already know how everything ends up, and so you're sitting there kind of just, like, reading through one eye, thinking, like, oh god, how does this happen? Like, I know you don't live. Like, I know that you infest an Andalite. I know that, like, the entire species is, like, done for.
And yes, yet, these are the books of existential dread.
Yes, they are. They're very anxious-making and unsettling, and, like, I was reading this and just was very upset by it. If you have, like, something like a stuffed animal you'd like to cuddle right now to make yourself feel better about the Hork-Bajir, then I would suggest doing so. And it occurs to me, too, as I look down at my cover, the cover on the Animorphs, there's, like, a shiny, like, star pattern of, like, holographic-y, like, shiny copper pattern on the book, which I think is awfully festive for what the book is about.
Yeah, it should just have a black cover.
It really should. And just say, like,
abandoned hope. You can read this.
Yes, and with, like, a little, like, tissue dispenser in it. That would be nice as well. So we're getting majorly off track here. So the core conflict between, in this book, because, I mean, the story is pretty basic, you know, Yeerks invade Hork-Bajir world, start taking over Hork-Bajir, a resistance forms, they call for help from the Andalites come, realize it's too far gone, and then take drastic measures in order to try and, like, stamp it out, and then everything is sad. But so the character conflict is really to do with Dak and Aldrea, and sort of the conversation between individuals of two different species who are very different and who have to sort of, I don't know, understand one another and learn to respect one another, especially from Aldrea's side. And coming from her main issue when she interacts with Dak is, how much do I tell him? Which, in a vacuum, makes her seem like a douche. But knowing that she's Ciro's daughter, it's a huge, like, concern. And, you know, a kindness can easily be the destruction of a species, and so...
Yeah, because, I mean, you could say that what she does with Dak is the same as what her father did. Like, she teaches him things that he didn't have before.
Yeah.
And then, by extension, like, you know, he becomes the Orcfisher leader when necessary. He becomes their general, and then they have things that they didn't have before. And, like, at one point, when they're fighting, he looks at his people and is like, oh, great, I turned them into killers.
Yeah.
Sweet. That's, which they had never been before.
That's one of the most sort of upsetting things about this, about the Horcrux's journey as, like, a species, is that we know that, and luckily there's a glimmer of light, like, way at the end of the tunnel, which is the Horcrux colony in the valley. Like, we know that's coming, and that's, like, you know, phew, that's, like, a little hope to hold on to, because we know that the whole species is going to be enslaved, and because of the actions of Aldrea in the book, they are turned, they sort of evolve from their natural Horcrux state to something, you know, very foreign to them, in that they are murderers and killers. They're violent. They become violent out of self-defense, but it's still, like, does that, you know, does that change the fact that a peaceful species has now become violent? And I think that the conversation is even further muddled with the reveal that the Horcrux were created about halfway through. When the Yerks come, Dak and Aldrea have no choice but to run. And so the Horcrux world is constructed with trees up to the sky, which is, in their mythology, Mother Sky. And then below the ground, there's sort of like a crack in the earth, and it's blue. It's like blue mist underneath it, which sounds pretty cool, not gonna lie.
Sounds like Amazon Trail.
Yeah, and so that's called Father Deep, and the Horcrux don't go there. They don't like it. They think that it will kill them. And Dak and Aldrea have no choice but to go into Father Deep when the Yerks are pursuing them, and lo and behold, there's like monsters there, and they kill the Yerks, and Dak and Aldrea kind of like get through. And when they're down in Father Deep, they eventually discover, like, this species called the Arn, which I can't remember how they're described. In my head, they're, like, giant moths. Is that right? I don't know. I can't remember.
They're, like, there's definitely triangles involved.
Okay.
Maybe.
Alright. Well, no worries. It doesn't matter what they look like. The reveal with the Arn is that the Arn created the Horcrux on the Horcrux planet to take care of the trees so that the trees would balance the oxygen levels, in the atmosphere so that it was breathable. They basically create and genetically engineer the Horcrux to not have any ambitions beyond sort of the simple pleasures of eating bark and sort of curating the, like, you know, they're like gardeners. God bless them. So it's a huge shock to Dak to find out that his people were engineered, and in that he feels like he's a pawn to the Arn, and he feels like he stands to be a pawn to the Yerks, and he's also a pawn to Aldrea and the Andalites. And so sort of the plight of the Horcrux in this novel is very tragic in that there's no easy answer for Dak, in that he is representative of his species, but not really, because they don't understand things to the level that he does, and what he understands, you know, brings him sort of like pain, and what he knows about the future brings him pain, and what he knows about what his people are really, like, going to be, you know, fated to is painful. Like, it's just, I love Dak so much because of this, like, this horrible burden that he bears.
Plus, it gives him responsibility, mm-hmm. because he can't pretend to not know things that he does. He can't take the information that Aldrea gives him and do nothing with it, you know. So, in that way, like, yeah, you do feel bad for him, because it becomes a question of, are you going to try to save your people? Because you're the only one who can, or, you know, are you just going to let them be enslaved?
Right. Well, that's
like,
the,
is it
worse, like,
to just, like, give in, or when you know that it's, like, inevitable, or fight when you know that it's inevitable?
That's the thing, is sort of the choices that the characters are presented with are just really difficult, horrible choices. And with Dak, it's, you know, Aldrea sees it very clearly. Now, she, of course, this is not her people. These are not her people. And so it's very easy for her to have sort of a staunch view, which is when you are under attack, you must fight to save your people, which is all well and good, but at what cost? At what cost to the Horcrux people do they stand up and fight for themselves? And do they fully understand what they're fighting for? Literally, what Aldrea says to them to get them to fight against the Yerk is do what Dak does. Do what he does. And she repeats it. And she sort of manipulates their lack of understanding and sort of, like, nuanced, like, understanding of the world around them and what the situation is requiring of them, and just tells them to ape, like, mimic Dak, which Dak feels horrible about. Like, his whole species just rests on his shoulders, and it sucks, and there's nothing that he can do that doesn't require a great sacrifice of something.
Plus, it's really terrible for him to see what Aldrea is doing and how she is using them, and know that, like, okay, this is, like, my only ally, and she is my friend, but I can still see that she's manipulating us, and she's using me, and I'm never gonna be on her level just because she is an Andalite, and this is how she's been raised. And so, I mean, at the end, it's kind of ironic that she becomes a Horcrux.
It is. Well, and that's the... I think that their conflict and their dynamic is really interesting, because they have hints of sort of the, like, star-crossed lovers thing that, you know, a lot of narratives love to put two sort of ill-fated lovers at the center of much larger global complicated conflicts, as it were. But for my money, I like what K.A. does with Dak and Aldrea because of that, because it's so complicated, and it's not a clear-cut, like, they love each other so much. They're reliant on each other. They understand one another more than anyone else in their world. I mean, and what we haven't said is that Aldrea's family is killed by the Yerks, like, their house. She's the only one who really leaves the house and does anything, and their house, their scoop, is completely destroyed by the Yerks, and she kind of has the, like, Luke Skywalker moment of returning home to just, like, ashes and smoke. And from there on out, her compass is very much revenge. And so, in that way, we understand Aldrea, and we know that even though she's kind of a dick to Dak, we understand her. Like, we get where she's coming from, and we can't really blame her for wanting to take out the Yerks and avenge, like, her family's death. But at the same time, how she behaves with Dak is super shady, and I love that Dak knows it. I love that Dak is never gullible to what she's doing, and he calls her on it, and she sometimes admits it, not always, because she knows that she shouldn't be doing it, but like all Andalites, it's like, well, there's, like, a higher purpose by which that I can excuse myself being, like, an asshole.
Yeah, like, at one point, she's, you know, talking about how, oh, you know, if we get off-world, then he can see the stars, and he's like, you didn't need to say that to me, like, I would have helped you anyway.
Yeah.
So, like, ultimate, like, their ultimate relationship is so much better than it would have been if, like, it had been a real star-crossed lover story where, right, like, two people from different races fall in love. And so, like, the story is about them being together, or, like, you know, fighting to be together. But even at the end, when she works in the Delt, like, I mean, we assume that they're going to get together, but it's not. And by then, it's like, okay, at points you have hated each other, like, you know, and you used each other, and, like, all of this stuff.
What I love about it, like, what you just said, you said that most narratives, it's like two people struggling to stay together when their differences are trying to pull them apart. And Dak and Aldrea are kind of the opposite. Their differences sort of force them together, despite the fact that, like, they probably don't want to be together. They would love to, like, not have to deal with one another, but their circumstances force them to collide, and they have to sort of, like cope with that and deal with that. And that's such a, like, subversion of what that trope is that makes it, you want to see them work it out. You want to see them be together. And when you say, you know, in the end, she morphs a Horcrux and stays a Horcrux. And that's not a moment of, I don't know, I feel like, how much are we referencing Twilight accidentally here? I feel like we're dancing all around Twilight without actually saying Twilight. And I've never read Twilight, but in Twilight, I mean, Bella becomes a vampire, does she not? And that's, like, that's a thing that she wants. Which, in its own right, like, that's something different as well. Like, not a lot of narratives have a human character say, like, make me this, like, dark being that you have, like, set up as, you know, this wolf, vampire, whatever. You don't get it. Like, usually it's a victimization thing. So on the one hand, it is great that, like, Bella's like, I'm gonna do it, I want this. But at the same time, it's framed very much as sort of, like, a celebration. It's something that's earned, and the scene is, like, a positive thing. Whereas Aldrea becoming a Horcrux is almost a concession, and it's almost a last resort. It is a last resort.
It means that she's going to die.
Yeah.
Like, she makes that choice. If she had, because the quantum virus is tagged to work with your physiology, like, it wouldn't have harmed her if she was an Andalite.
Right. It's an interesting decision. I don't mean to, okay, I'm going to go sort of rewind on having it be, I feel like as a reader, it's a good choice. Like, it's a rewarding choice as an audience member to see that Aldrea chooses to be a Horcrux, especially after all the sort of, like, Andalite BS that she's sort of been, like, mired in the whole time. That, again, is, like, understandable. We, like, get it. But we also, like, I appreciate that K.A. Applegate doesn't just sort of make the Andalites, like, the good guys, and then put, like, capes on them and just, like, let them be really one-dimensionally just, like, great. That there are sort of negative sort of side effects of being the quote-unquote heroes of the galaxy, and that those sort of manifest and really shade their point of view, especially in how they deal with quote-unquote lesser species like the Horcrux. So I think that Aldrea choosing to become a Horcrux is, like, a really great choice, and it's interesting framing it as well in terms of her heritage. I mean, ultimately, like, her father was sort of like a living betrayal of the Andalites, and there's nothing more sort of betraying of your species than ditching it and becoming another one.
Literally leaving it behind.
Yeah. But at that point, it's a choice as well. Not necessarily, this is another interesting thing about it. It's very layered. It's not necessarily a choice in terms of, like, she wants to be with Dak, she wants to be a Horcrux, she wants to have, like, she's making a principled stand because of the fact that the Andalites roll in and are like, well, we got a solution, everybody, don't worry. And it's like, oh, great, what is it? And it's like, we're just gonna kill everybody, it's cool. And it's like, no, that's not a good solution, I don't want that. And that's sort of what Aldrea sees that as a betrayal of her people to her. Because she led this little resistance on the Horcrux world for a while, which, by the way, feels very similar to what our kids are doing present day. She and Dak are sort of, like, leading this, like, Horcrux resistance. And they sent out a message to the Andalites, like, hey, it's getting really bad. Can you come here, please? Like, we need you. And this is such a wonderful, small thing that ends up to have such a big impact that they mentioned very early on, Aldrea says that she wants to be a warrior, but, like, she really is not suited for it because she is female. And that sort of hinders her ability to, like, pursue that path. And so that comes back when she makes a call, like, a distress call to the Andalites, and basically says, like, send everybody you have, a planet is in danger. And they send, like, two ships. Because she's a female, and they're like, well, she probably, it's the sort of, like, little lady, like, pat on the head kind of thing.
You must be exaggerating.
Exactly. And so they send two ships, and get an Alarin, who was Prince Ciro's, like, underling. Of course, Alarin is the Andalite who eventually goes on to be the host body for Visser 3. Alarin shows up and looks around and is like, ah, crap. And so they fight a war for as long as possible, but then the only solution that he can see, that the Andalites can see, is they bring in a specially engineered virus to just basically wipe out the Horcrux and make it so that there isn't a species to enslave. And Dak and Aldrea, you know, Aldrea in particular can't believe that her people would do that. She's, like, horrified by it. And they go to the Arn, and the Arn are like, no, we can't help you. Even though we engineered you and we could probably do something, like, we're just gonna... And they try and say, like, Dak and Aldrea try and say, oh, well, like, it's gonna affect you. And they're like, eh, not so much, because we're just gonna, like, you know, we're gonna make it so that the Yerks can't actually, like, get into our ear canals. And then we'll just die anyways. Like, it's fine. We got a plan. And it's so bleak. And
the Arns are the worst.
The Arns are the worst. And it's like the people who have the power and responsibility are failing to...
Every turn.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah, failing to really do right by... Do right, really. The sentence could end there. Failing to do right. It's just horrific at every turn to see... these sort of quote-unquote greater species really drop the ball, and the Horpagir, who are minding their own business, so happy to be doing, you know, bark eating every day, all day, in and out, just, like, fall prey to, like, fall through the cracks, and just, like,
yeah, the subtitle of this book could be The Horpagir Chronicles, Ways to Abuse Power.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, that's it. I mean, the Yerks do it. Like, Alarin gives them power, and the Yerks are like, yeah, I think we're going to take over the universe. Is that cool? And then the Andalites have their power, and they hoard it now, and then they don't, you know, step up and sort of exert their power in useful ways anymore, because they're, like, chicken shit, because Zero did it for something nice, and then the Yerks were douches about it. And then the Arn are like, yeah... We created this species, but we're not really, like, responsible for you. We're just gonna let you die.
Exactly. That's probably why the Arn are my least favorite characters in this book. Like, which is saying a lot, because you have Yurks and Andalites to contend with. But I hate the Arn. I hate them. They're terrible.
They're awful. Like, everybody's a little bit awful. And so it creates this horrible situation for Dak and Aldrea to try and, like, cope with. So Aldrea morphs a Horpagir when it's revealed that the Andalites are just going to release a virus and kill everybody. And thereby sort of, yeah, like Diana said, sealing her fate, basically said, like, she will die with the Horpagir people as opposed to live with the Andalites and, like, the knowledge that they really screwed the pooch. Which is such, but, like, what's ironic is that's such an Andalite thing to do.
It is.
To, like,
I mean, she has the ability to do it, and she does it. And
Lathan Mitchell. Yeah, like, it's funny that she's acting against her people, because the trait that she sort of cuts off her nose to spite her face, because she puts, like, a principle above living, like, above survival.
They don't really have noses.
No, they don't, that's true. They've all cut off their noses to spite their face, that's why it happened.
She cut off her eye stalks.
Suddenly, yeah. It's ironic, then, that she sort of chooses that route. And then when she does, they try and run away with the canister to sort of, like, bury
they're
it.
Throw it into a deep and hope that it, like, burned up.
And hope that it killed all the Arns. That's what we were hoping.
It mutated on the way down and killed the Arns.
Exactly. But unfortunately, that did not happen. I don't know, more stuff happened in there. She had a conversation with Alarin at some point. Like, I don't know, like...
A lot of the Alarin stuff that we get in this book and the Andalite Chronicles is just so fascinating to me.
That's good.
Because I'm a backstory bitch.
You are. Please talk about it.
I like history books. I like the Silmarillion far more than Lord of the Rings. Like, I like knowing everything that happened before the main characters appear.
It's interesting.
I
grant you that.
Alarin is just really... I mean, he's not a good specimen, but he's a... exemplary specimen of Andalitehood.
And he's an interesting, like, character. Every character that's sort of put forth is sort of, like, meaty and complicated and interesting, and it should use a phrase a bit insensitively, considering that we're talking about Yerks, but it's interesting to get inside their heads.
Oh!
Aww. So the ultimate sad in this is that the canister, Dak and Aldrea lose track of it, and the next time they see it, the lid's off. Like, that's all you need to know.
Where is the Horpagir is carrying it? Because they were like, dude, we need this canister. If you see it, bring it to us.
Is it Jangle?
The guy brings it to them, and he's like, guys, I got it. And I'm like, Dude, it's open. Oh. You're about to die horribly.
Oh. Yeah. So, ultimately, Dak and Eldrea actually escape the virus. They are able to flee to a valley. It hasn't been, you know, touched by the virus yet. And they actually mate, and they have a kid, a son, Horpajir, and they name him Ciro. Which, this is like the Albus Severus of the Horpajir Chronicles. Like, why would you name him that?
It's kind of mean to saddle a kid, even a non-Andalite kid, with that name.
It is!
Like, too soon, guys. Like, maybe a few generations down.
And, like, I don't know. I feel like...
I thought it was more like, I mean, as much as I've been mocked that name choice, like, I thought it was her, like, making peace with her father. She has such contempt for him at the beginning, like, she thinks he's a fool. Like, she totally bought into, you know, what her culture says about him, which... And I can't really blame her, because it's like, pervasive on her whole world. I mean, they were exiled, so, you know, she has nothing but contempt for him, and how he, you know, has lost all purpose in life. So, you know, but I think by the end of the book, like, she understands what he did, because
she,
her own life.
She lived a similar life, where, I mean, early on, she sort of sees Ciro's kindness, the kindness, as foolishness, and simplicity is foolishness, and then she goes and lives on a planet full of creatures who are simple and kind, and then she becomes one of them. Her whole life is a big old, like, allegory for that. So in that regard, I can see it, like, making peace with her father. It still just makes me kind of go, like, really, dude? Could that be, like, a middle name? I don't know. It's fine. It's lovely. That's a nice thing to name your kid. So, and then Ciro has a kid, and then that kid has a kid, and that kid's Dak Humi, who's telling the story to Tobias in the valley. And so, luckily it has a happy-ish ending. The insinuation is that Dak and Eldrea die. They're, like, dead now, but they remained uninfested. Assumedly the virus got to them eventually.
Yeah, but we don't know enough about the virus to be like, how long does it last? Is it like, you know, like setting up a nuclear bomb where it affects, like, the land around it for generations?
Hmm.
Did Ciro and his family, like, get off planet at some point, like, fly away and escape the virus that way? Or did it just, like, dissipate?
Well, but at the same time, I mean, when we meet Dak Humi, he's a controller. So at some point, the lineage had to fall to the Yerks. It's just assumedly it didn't happen until Dak or even maybe Dak's father. I'd like to think that. I'm going to go ahead and think that... Or not Dak, sorry, Jera. I'd like to think that Dak and Eldrea sort of lived happily ever after and never were infested. The glimmering hope is that we know that there's a free colony of Horpajir living on Earth that the Animorphs are sort of, like, protecting. The story finishes with Jara sort of finishing the story about his great-grandfather Dak, or grandfather. We never really cleared that up. It's a simple fact check, but no worries. It's not even... We're not even going to pay attention to it. Doesn't matter.
I guess we should talk about the surgery, right?
Ugh. You can.
I mean, just briefly mention the fact that he's there.
Yes.
The whole time.
Yes.
Esplin, you interesting soul.
Yes. Well, okay, so no what? Now, I actually need clarification on this. Because he kept mysteriously dropping. He's like, yes, my twin. And I was like, wait, which one is the one that's going to be Visser 3 then? Is it 9466 or the other one? Are they both 9466? I don't... My Yerk knowledge is not great. Gotta brush up on this.
The 66 means that he is a twin.
Yes, I got that.
So, wait, now I don't know.
Exactly! I don't feel so bad about this now. That was...
Because one of the twins is, like, the Alpha twin, and the other is the Beta twin. I think it's the one that we have a point of view from... Otherwise, it'll be
fine,
I guess.
Well, and of course, like, it makes sense that here's this Yerk who's studied everything there is to know about Andalites, so when it comes along, like, when it comes time to have an Andalite body, it makes sense that, like, he would be the one to infest it. Also, something that was easy to forget for me was that the morphing technology is, in fact, technology, and it's not, like, something that Andalites are born with. And Eldrea talks about it in this book because, of course, it's important that she have her morphing power. In order to integrate with the Horpajir. She, like, her dad doesn't have morphing power. She makes it sound like no one else in her family does, but she, like, got access to it somehow.
She pulled what I would say is a Rachel.
Yes.
Because, like, one of her friend's parents is one of the people who developed the morphing power, and they, like, just had the blue box hanging out in their house, and she got to see it, and she used it, and was like...
She's the best. Okay, sometimes I really do love Aldrea. That, and you bring up a good point that I wanted to talk about, is that there are a lot of parallels or sort of familiarities in this story and how it connects to stories that we already know. Aldrea's story of integrating with the Horcrugeer is very similar to Elfanger's story of integrating with the humans. And it also connects to Tobias in a way, because at the end of the book, when Tobias is there, they show him Jara and Ket's daughter, who they've named Toby, who turns out to be a seer as well. So Tobias's namesake, who is a descendant of Dak and Aldrea, is, you know, a seer and is sort of echoing that sort of parallel. And I think that Aldrea and Dak have a kind of Rachel Tobias element to them, kind of loosely. Not like an overt parallel. And the fact, too, that, you know, the resistance that they lead is very similar to the one that, you know, Jake and company are doing now. While they're waiting for Andalites to get here. That's the whole sort of premise of the book series, is that they're waiting for the Andalites to just come. And in the meantime, they're sort of just, like, dragging along, fighting really sort of, like, sort of standoff battles where nobody really comes out a winner. They're just sort of biding time. So I think a lot of those, like, elements rang true to, like, what we know about, you know, other stories that we had heard.
Yeah, it's a good book for presenting parallels without, like, copying anything.
Right.
Like, the conflict is similar, but it's not the same. And the stakes are similar, but they're not the same. And, like, or the stakes are the same, but they're
different
people.
Right.
Different species. So, like, I mean, Beric's not, like, it's total frontal assault on world, but they have to infiltrate Earth, and so, like, it's a different kind of war. So everything, like, you know, you can compare the two, and they call back to each other, but it's not, like, boring or rehashed, I don't think.
Right, I agree. Well, and it's kind of cool, too, that they mention... infiltrating the Horcrugeer world isn't difficult because they don't have to be covert, but they mention, like, well, with species that are more intelligent, we're going to have to create underground, you know... Kandrona rays and Yurt pools, and so they kind of allude to sort of what their MO is going to be when it comes time to attack Earth.
Thanks, guys. Thanks
yeah.
for practicing.
Thanks a lot. So yeah, so I think, does that do it? Is that everything?
I think we've talked over most of the most devastating aspects.
I think so. All of the devastating aspects. There's so many. Okay, so now that we have concluded our sojourn to Sad Town, a.k.a. the Horcrugeer home planet, we are gearing up to read the 23rd book in the Animorph series, The Pretender, on which Tobias is morphing into a rabbit. In the meantime, try not to cry a million tears over the Horcrugeer and the story that K.A. Applegate destroyed us with. So until we talk about number 23... we will sign off and cry about Horcrugeer.